Herzlich willkommen zum On the Way to New Work Podcast. Ich bin heute in Lissabon beim House of Beautiful Business, einer fantastischen Veranstaltung, die Tim Leberecht, der auch schon bei uns im Podcast zu Gast war, vor einigen Jahren ins Leben gerufen hat. Zeitgleich zum Web Summit in Lissabon, aber mittlerweile ein völlig eigenes Format mit 500-600 Gästen aus der ganzen Welt. Sehr, sehr innovatives Format, 5 Tage lang in einem Beautiful House. Und es geht um Beautiful Business, also darum, wie wir in Zukunft Wirtschaft ein bisschen besser und schöner gestalten können. Mir gegenüber sitzt Lisa Choi Owens von TED. Ja, ihr habt richtig gehört, von TED, der fantastischen Konferenzplattform, der besten, der erfolgreichsten, die es weltweit gibt. And I switch over to English now, and I'm very happy to be here, Lisa.
Well, thank you so much. I'm happy to be here, too.
And you're so nice that you waited here for me 20 minutes because I was at the wrong place.
No problem.
Thank you for this as well. So I explained a little bit up front how our podcast works. And so you know our first question is always, how did you become the person you are now?
Yeah, I am kind of the typical American dream story. My parents were immigrants from Korea. They came with, I think, something like $800 in their pockets and no English and no college education, and basically killed themselves working for our my sister and me to have a great education. So they were dry cleaners, entrepreneurs. Obviously, it's kind of the easier path when you don't have a traditional education in the United States. And we ended up moving to California, and I ended up being part of the fantastic University of California system, got into Berkeley. I always tell people that my first semester in college was $800. My last semester was $1,600. I think those days are long gone.
where was it?
UC Berkeley.
Yeah, when was it? At what time was
it? I graduated in 1994.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
So it's pretty astonishing what the type of education I was able to get for that tuition. It's really unbelievable, and it was a gift. And, you know, then I also then had to make a series of choices because I didn't exactly have a safety net with my parents financially. And so I went for the jobs that would pay off debt and just kind of get me financially comfortable. And
okay.
So
yeah.
I ended up on Wall Street, which, you know, in hindsight, it was not exactly the most introspective moment of my mm-hmm. life. It was more being courted by the big banks and being flown to New York and, you know, thinking I can handle this. And
but probably the fastest track to pay all
and the fastest debt, so. Track to mm-hmm. pay off all that debt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wish I had spent more time thinking about what it is that I enjoy and what what suits my personality. And instead I made a financial decision, and sometimes that has to be done. And, you know, for a variety of reasons, I was glad I did it, but eventually I learned it was not for me.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of in the throes of some pretty inappropriate behaviors on Wall Street. I was, you know, deep in it with stories that I tell younger colleagues of mine, and they can hardly believe how challenging it was. I was on the trading floor, and
could you give one example you would tell me?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Knowing that there are maybe 30,000 people listening
yeah.
to it.
Oh gosh, because we were on the trading floor, we have the squawk boxes essentially, and prices are kind of being yelled out on the floor. And when women came back from maternity leave, men would be shouting out numbers that were basically how much weight she'd put on while she was on maternity leave. So that was just one small example. It certainly toughened me up. I definitely got thicker skin, but I also realized this is not the kind of environment. It's just not sustainable. So yeah, I mean, I certainly learned what I don't want to do. And I think that's part of the process, right? Mm. I mean, when you're 22 years old, how do you really know what a career looks like? You don't, because you're not taught that in school. So, and then I moved on to a very strange transition, but it'll make sense in a moment. I worked for Tommy Hilfiger because friends of mine who worked at Lehman Brothers, which no longer exists,
mm-hmm.
Actually did the IPO for Tommy Hilfiger.
Mm-hmm,
so since
mm-hmm.
all of us young analysts in New York City were hanging out together, it just kind of made sense. And then I applied to business school, and I ended up going to Harvard Business School, which I think was a moment for my parents, you know, to come from.
To be very proud.
Yeah, yeah. They were extremely proud. It was, and it was, what it taught me too was that whole time, I kind of felt there was some secret society, a secret language, a series of rules and tracks that people take under the surface that I wasn't privy to because mm-hmm. I didn't grow up with privilege. And it was really a moment that kind of allowed me to relish. I just worked, the fact that I just worked hard. Mm-hmm. I had no tricks up my sleeve. I had no special recommendation letters. I didn't know the right people. Mm-hmm. And the system seemed to work out. And it was definitely a moment that gave me a bit of hope. Mm-hmm. After having thought that there was no shot, you know, for someone like me with my background.
Wow. And was Harvard the same story? Mm-hmm. You had to raise money to be able to pay for it?
And yeah. Then, yeah. Yeah. I mean, no, I just went into severe debt because that's the plight of young people. And I think it's much, much worse for people now, particularly in undergrad. So I ended up choosing the path that was the path du jour. It was the internet. So when I graduated in 1999, it was just moments before the crash. And, you know, it was alluring. There was no way not to do it, I would say. It used to be the domain of, oh, I want to go into private equity. I want to do, you know, venture capital, et cetera. But then, you know, once the whole internet thing happened, which back then was relatively new, there was just no way that I couldn't do it. And so that was kind of when I started in digital media, and mm-hmm. I have kind of essentially been in it since, even in this new role at TED. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did you live through this crash period? Were you already in a job when it happened?
Oh, yeah. Yep. No. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I worked for theknot.com, mm-hmm. which is like Tie the Knot. It was a wedding portal. I also happened to be engaged at the time, so it was very opportunistic. And we went through the whole IPO process, which... But like a lot of things, I always tell people, you should live in New York City and you should do this. Like going public, if you have the opportunity to be in a place where you have that experience, I think it's worth it. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, it was short-lived. So that was December of 99 and then March 2000 happened. And so I've been through multiple cycles of ups and downs. I was in telecom after that in mobile software, and there was a telecom bubble that burst. So my skin's pretty thick.
How did you manage this to get through this phases? Many people get depressive and they ask themselves, am I good enough? But you seem to be a very strong personality, very confident. How did you manage? Did you meditate? What was your recipe in this period? Or would you say, well, I'm good. I know I'm good. I will find the next thing.
Gosh, I wish I was as good as someone who can meditate. I try now in my older years. But sometimes I think when you don't have a cushion, when you don't, necessity, I mean, just truthfully, survival. Hmm. Those are things that kick in and they have a pretty strong place for me. I've obviously done better over time, but at some point it was just, you got to pick yourself up and keep going. And I guess at that point I'd always assumed, okay, I'm educated. I have some skills. I believe I'm somewhat marketable. I'll move on. And what I've learned actually out of each of these crises is how resilient, in fact, I am. And that generally speaking, I don't know how to talk about it today. Our economy is generally fairly resilient. But it's an experience that I think gives me more patience. It certainly makes me more appreciative when I am in a good situation and when I do feel some level of stability. And it also makes me more prepared for what is likely to come because it's cyclical. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. At some point, as you get older, this the nature of the cycle says you're going to go through this a number of times if you're lucky enough to live a relatively long life. And so as long as you understand that and you've lived through it once or twice, you start to see the pattern and you prepare.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that sounds good. When I now compare your job you're doing right now with your story, I can see a big... Yeah, it fits for me I believe with your story in mind to work for a platform which is open to everyone in the world, which offers the best inspiration, education, discussions. It seems the natural fit. But was it the first job where you felt, well, now I'm there where I was meant for, or where did you feel for the first time that your job, your skills and your... Mm-hmm. Your personal story matched?
I would say that this finally is the first place where there does feel like there's a match. Part of it is since so much of my life was based on the opportunity that came from being educated and having access to knowledge, like in its purest form, that's truly what allowed me to kind of have the life that I've had and whatever successes I've had are through education and through knowledge. And so to end up in a place that is also now focused in a different way on education and knowledge is kind of a perfect fit. The other thing that I think that's really distinct about TED versus other places when you just listen to a TED talk, there's always a possibility embedded inside of the talk. It's never just lamenting what's wrong and leaving the audience to just be depressed. There's always this moment that there's a solution, there's something that can happen that will improve whatever situation is being described in that talk. And I think I've lived a life of what's possible. And so from that perspective, there's a tremendous amount of alignment. And I also think it's, I've just kind of found my people. I'm just innately curious. I love lots and lots of banter. And I found people where I feel like I can kind of very naturally speak and question and have healthy debates at work. And that's not always the case. It's kind of in the water at TED. But again, we're pretty non-traditional. Like, it's not massively hierarchical. It's still relatively small. We all share a mission. These are all little elements that make a culture a bit more open. And it certainly suits me better than any other job I've had.
Let's dive a little bit deeper into it. So many of my friends listen to TED Talks. I have one friend who spent many of the original conferences. His name is Lars Hinrichs. He's the founder of Xing, which is the German version of LinkedIn.
I just spoke with him yesterday.
Yeah, he's a big fan. He said, "Michael, you have to come." But it's not that simple. You have to go through this application process you mentioned before.
Yeah, of course.
But once in a while I meet people with highly educated that never heard about TED. So you now have the chance to tell us and our listeners a little bit more about TED. What is the history? How did it evolve? Where are you now? What is your mission?
And
so on.
Yeah, sure. It's one of those rare moments. It's, you know, very few times where people don't know what it is. And then I actually struggle for a moment because at its surface, it's kind of a strange thing to describe. Oh, somebody gets up and talks on a red circle with big red letters behind them. And on so many levels, it feels like it's indefensible, this concept, which is really just finding people who have a reason to share extraordinary ideas. That's kind of it. I mean, like, nobody has a lock on public speaking. No one has a lock on a red circle. No one has a lock on filming and distributing talks. It certainly is replicated all day, every day throughout the world. But there are a couple things that I see are different now that I'm here. And they're very unsexy. One of them is just the hard work and discipline that goes into preparing talks. And I'll say there's a huge difference when you go somewhere and you sit in an audience at a conference and there's just a panel and there are a few people just chatting with some microphones or a fireside chat where it's just two people sitting down in a chair and talking. I mean, it's certainly interesting, but the level of
200 PowerPoints
or 300 pages in a PowerPoint, that's the status quo. Yeah. It's because it's actually a lower lift. It's easier not to self-edit. It's easier to have volume and to just keep going. And the discipline that requires you to choose your words carefully, to care about the story arc and the emotional journey that you're taking somebody on versus just expressing your points of view or your idea or your knowledge base in bullet points, that's the easier path. And so we don't allow people to do that because they have plenty of opportunities to do that. But when you have to be introspective and think long and hard, what is the essence of what it is that I'm trying to transfer over to you?
What is the narrative?
What is the narrative and what's the kernel of the idea at the center of what it is I'm trying to share? That distillation takes a tremendous amount of discipline. And we're there really to support them in being able to find that diamond because it's already within them. That's kind of the other element of this is that people who do give a talk have to have had some relevant experience surrounding it. So either they're an academic having done research in it, or they physically did the job, had a personal experience that was obviously deeply attached to that idea. And so a lot of times people misread and misunderstand that what they think is an idea is in fact just a personal opinion. Or what they think is an idea just is a story.
Mm-hmm.
And those things have their place. We're inundated with people's opinions and people's stories. But an idea, I think, is essentially very different. And so the amount of work that it takes for people to get through what seems like an effortless talk on the stage is only gotten to through just tremendous discipline and hard work. And I've just seen it over and over again. If you invest the time and energy to care deeply about each word that you put together and the order in which you put them together and to self-edit and to practice and practice and practice, that's the secret. It seems replicable, but I don't know if the combination of all of those things somehow is something that people can repeat. I'm not sure why. I know people try.
We have so many more elements. What I think makes TED special, I think the limitation to say, well, it's 18 minutes or what is it, 15?
Well, it used to be kind of known as 18 minutes, but that standard's kind of somewhere between 12, 15 minutes, right? Yep.
It's amazing to have it this short and crisp. And I think if people manage to tell their idea in this short amount of time, then it can be good. If you need 2 hours, then you lose people. And what I like as well is that you have so often totally new perspectives.
Yes.
So let's say a doctor who says, well, the best thing which happened in my life was that I get a stroke because I am a doctor for this kind of things. I
say, well,
it's so amazing. It's so deep. It's so, you say, you're sitting there and say, wow, or this top model, which has not their own legs. And she
says,
she was
course.
Playing with the length and she was humorous. She was humble. She was beautiful. And there are so many emotions that people transform with their kind of talks.
Yeah,
or Bill Gates with his, what was it, a fly? Or what he was having with this to describe how malaria?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I remember that.
So I'm a big fan. And I have to say, I try to... as I mentioned, I did 2 TEDx talks and I read 2 books about how to do a proper TED talk.
Sure.
The better one was by Chris Anderson. And my wife, who is a shamanic healer, she was asked from my Rotary Club, where the average age is, I would say, 68, 69, very conservative, nice people, 99 men, 1 woman.
Oh, boy.
She was asked to do a speech about shamanism. And I said, well, I would not use slides. I would try to do it in a TED talk format. And then I tried to coach her a little bit, explaining how she could do so. And she just did it last week, and she really prepared herself so well.
Right,
she tried it once again and once again. And she, I'm since 10 years member in this Rotary Club, and I've never seen someone who get that much applause and get so many questions that she get, even if the topic was so out of the comfort zone of many of our members.
Right.
But they were so excited and generous and said, well, you really touched us. And she, when she started the talk, she said, well, my goal is to at least touch everyone in this room one time.
Yeah.
If I get this, I drive luckily home.
Yeah.
So then I said, wow. Yeah, and I think you can train this. You can use the TED talks as examples. You can read the book, which is really I think the best book which ever was written about doing
public speaking.
But I mean, it's more than just having this great idea and bringing this great people. I mean, you're a huge organization. You have this one big conference a year. You have many more formats. You have this TEDx thing. You have the video platform. Maybe you can explain a little bit about the business model behind TED. How you're doing this?
Of course. So TED was started in 1984 by a fellow named Richard Saul Wurman. And you'd be stunned, in the very beginning, they had talks that were 2 hours long. So the iteration of TED that you know now was really quite different than it was then. Then it was closed. It was about 1,000 people. It wasn't filmed. Obviously, the internet wasn't a thing, so it wasn't really an option back then. But it was still trying to find cool new ideas that are unexpected and looking in kind of different corners to find angles on things that were novel and interesting. So that same DNA kind of continued on after Chris bought it and transformed it into a nonprofit in 2001. When he bought it, classification as a nonprofit really opened a lot of doors with regard to how we could run the business. And what it allowed him to do was to be extremely generous with it and just be free with lending our brand and our mission out to the world because he found so much enthusiasm around it. And since the mission wasn't to build a multi-billion dollar brand, but rather to share ideas, since that was a central mission, it became very easy for him to kind of share this thing freely on the internet or to give a format for TEDx, which is a volunteer network of people volunteering their time freely to put on all of these different TED events. We've got TED Ed clubs and a bunch of other initiatives, TED Fellows, et cetera, where for the most part, and we've translators, we probably have 30,000 translators that essentially volunteer their time. So establishing ourselves as a nonprofit meant everyone knows that, you know, we're not here for profit. Not that there's anything wrong with that, if that's the business model that you're in, but it does allow for the generosity to occur, and people are pretty much always well-intentioned in that circumstance. Yeah, there's an outlier here or there that may kind of use it for too much personal gain, but for the most part, when it's mission-based, people really get in line. And so what we do is we have our conferences, obviously. We have a few different flagships here and there. That is where the majority of the talks happen. And, you know, we have about 100 talks. It takes a year. I mean, that is the amount of time it takes to go out and find those people and to piece them together and have them prepare their talks. But it goes well beyond that. That's a tiny fraction because that's only a couple thousand people that are able to attend. Mm-hmm. Whereas we distribute them out into the world and have hundreds of millions of viewers. And that's really the essence of what people, most people are familiar with at TED. It's, you know, well over 95% of our reach comes through the online platforms because how many people can make it to Vancouver, right? And so through the translation project, it's translated into, I think, 116 languages. We're like legitimately in every corner and make those talks available. So that as a platform has been pretty unbelievable. The one thing that is different and unique, and this is, I'm sure, why you've enjoyed going to the TEDx events and want to go to TED, there is also a special relationship between the ideas. So this notion of curation, which is really special and distinct inside of TED, says this is a really cool idea, but these five together are actually more potent when you see them, and they look like they're unrelated, but I promise you at the end of this journey, you're going to see that your aperture has been opened and it's really broadened your view on a topic that you didn't understand. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the other secret sauce that comes through the special experience of actually being at one of our conferences is because we curate talks together, which is not usually the online experience. Usually you're just kind of listening to a talk, you know, you go to work, you come back, you listen to another talk in the car, et cetera. But when you piece them together, there's real magic.
Yeah, wow.
Gleich geht's weiter mit On the Way to New Work. Hier kommt die ganz kurze Werbeunterbrechung und unser Werbepartner ist euch nicht unbekannt. Es ist Hallo Freelancer. Hallo Freelancer ist ein Service von Xing und hilft euch dabei, kurzfristig Projektvakanzen mit passenden Freelancern zu besetzen und greift dabei auf das größte Business-Netzwerk in Deutschland, Österreich und der Schweiz zu, nämlich Xing. 450.000 Freelancer werden mit intelligentem Matching für euch gesucht und zusammengebracht vom Softwareentwickler über UX-Designer, Interim Manager, Copywriter, was man alles so braucht. Und so könnt ihr in sehr kurzer Zeit eben eine Vakanz besetzen, wenn ihr das in einem Projekt braucht. Die hohen Kosten für Vermittlung entfallen. Es geht nämlich keine Vermittlungsgebühr und es ist eben eine kostenlose Freelancer-Empfehlung. Das heißt, ihr könnt damit eben eigene Freelancer-Pools erweitern. Das ist das, was wirklich spannend ist. Wie gesagt, 450.000 Freelancer aus dem gesamten Xing-Netzwerk. Das ist wirklich sehr, sehr spannend. Und deswegen lohnt sich einfach mal der Blick, wenn ihr schnell und günstig den passenden Freelancer für euer Projekt finden wollt, auf die Seite hallofreelancer.com/newwork. Da findet ihr nochmal alle Informationen. Und jetzt viel Spaß mit dem Rest der Folge.
How do you make sure that you find the right people? I mean, the concept is that you have experts and people from all over the place. There are doctors, there are engineers, there are crazy people, models. You have from all places if they have a good idea. Who is evaluating this? Do you have, let's say, a board of experts or experts for every discipline?
Yep. So we have a team of curators. Mm-hmm. I think the most equivalent would be like an editor at a magazine or a newspaper, but it is different. So first of all, I think we're fortunate at this stage of the game because we're a flywheel, essentially. If you have an idea and you want to share it with the world, I think the very first thing you think of is, oh, I want to give a TED Talk on that, because it's a platform. Like, it's an enormous platform. We're a surprisingly small team. We have about 230, I think, full-time employees. We're highly levered because we have armies of volunteers who give so much to the TED community. But we have a relatively small team of curators.
And the headquarters is Vancouver?
No, the headquarters is New York City.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Usually people think actually we're somewhere in Silicon Valley or somewhere in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But some of them are generalists. And then we obviously have people that are more subject matter experts, where there is a different level of technical expertise that's required. Science, tech. We have design, a business curator, and then a couple of generalists. But it's a relatively small team. I'm going to say maybe 7 or 8. And that the flywheel effect of being the de facto kind of place where people want to give their ideas, mm-hmm, is that many come in the door. So we have 25,000 people that apply online. And then we have the experts from the last 20 years who've given their talks, who are at the top of their game, who know other people who are at the top of their game. And so then the recommendations start to kind of flow. And the network effect is a multiplier. It's a huge amplifier for us. And so we're fortunate in that. A lot of the ideas come to us, and then it's up to us to vet. And then, truly, these guys come, they travel. The curators go out and about, and they meet with tons of different people, and they start kind of ferreting out, different speaker ideas and different topics. And that's their job all day, to think about what's the new idea.
Does it work the other way around sometimes, that they see people, find people, read about people, say, well, you should do a talk
absolutely. Yeah. They'll go out and source on their own.
Okay.
So I don't have any idea what the percentage is of who comes to us or how they do it. But, my colleague is here with me, and she's coming here to scout out talent and to listen to see if there's any cool new ideas that she think can take the stage.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. And maybe we talk a little bit about your role at TED. So what is your job exactly?
Yeah. So I think we're going to be speaking about this tomorrow, mm-hmm, with Tim. I'm chief revenue officer, mm-hmm, and I'm head of partnerships. So that means I'm responsible for funding the mission, because mm-hmm, we're a nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So like any nonprofit or any for-profit, it's a business, and you have to make enough money to pay people and manage the operations. And so that's what we do. And some of the revenue comes from conferences, obviously, but a big portion of it comes through partnerships. And so mm-hmm, what that means is companies are always looking for new opportunities to change their culture, to inspire their leadership, to showcase thought leadership, and actually to manage through what is an increasingly challenging marketplace that's being consistently disrupted by technology, business models are shifting, et cetera. And I think there are a lot of companies that are either feeling like there's not enough innovation in their company, or they're stuck in the business model that they're in and having a really hard time kind of, again, taking the blinders off. That is the most chronic set of problems that I hear over and over again. But when you think about where are you going to go to fix that, who's going to help you? There's, the spate of management consulting firms, mm-hmm, which absolutely mm-hmm have their place. But there's something distinct and unique about TED, which says, I'm going to force you to think about ideas differently, and to look in corners of the world and other industries to learn from. And so we provide this, I would say, like perspective gathering to people through a variety of things. First, they can come to our conferences, and they come because they need to be inspired. I mean, you go to any one of our conferences, whether it's a TEDx or a TED, I promise you walk away with, you know, 20 ideas that you didn't know you should care about, right? It's this whole idea of, I don't know what I don't know. Like, this is the beauty of TED. You learn about things you didn't know matter, and that can help inform your decisions. So now you're just generally more informed. And we can bring that to you through our digital platforms. We have many different vehicles and other custom events where we can bring ideas into your organization. It just depends on what it is you're trying to do. We are also equipped to find ideas from inside your company. So if you're a relatively large organization, we have something called the TED Institute, which basically replicates exactly what you see from Vancouver, that whole process over that course of the year to find and prepare talks, just on a much smaller scale. So we'll do it inside of large organizations.
A TED white label.
A TED at, it's kind of a, it's not a white label.
No, but TED tailor-made. Tailor-made for,
yeah,
for
that's
organizations.
Right. Where the same discipline is replicated inside an organization. That means the organization needs to have some mass, right? There has to be some scale. So, you know, an example of, you know, BCG with 100,000 employees or UPS that has 450,000 employees, we make the call and say, do you have an idea? Please share it. And we're going to go ahead and curate ideas from inside the organization. And I think the reason that that's so powerful is to presume that those ideas aren't inside the companies is silly.
Absolutely.
The gigantic majority of people who make it onto the stage at TED have a job, right? And when you actually go to the source, they are the closest to the problems, the inefficiencies, the resources, and many times they don't feel that they have an outlet to share some novel new ideas. And there is something about the invitation to give a TED Talk that unlocks that. It gives a permission that doesn't exist in the standard mechanism of, oh, you know, the CEO's door is always open. Just tell your boss. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it is. It doesn't quite have the same type of an invitation.
Yeah, we had a guest in our podcast, which was funny. It was a surprise guest. So we had a little conference about our podcast, 100 people, all listeners. And we said, well, we want one out of this group to be guests in our podcast.
Yeah.
Over the day, you can decide among you who should this be.
Uh-huh.
And I was like this. And then there was, at the end of the day, we asked again, and then there was one who said, well, I would love to be guest on your podcast, but here's someone who's much better. And then he described a 26-year-old young lady sitting next to him. She's of the HR team, a member of the HR team of an agency.
Yes.
I said, should it be? And he explained why. And then we had her and did this podcast with her, and she told when she came into this agency, she found out that there were so many people with good ideas, and she said, well, let's do a conference just with our people.
Yes.
And not about advertising, about everything.
No, right,
and she said there were so many 3 days, so many good talks, inspiring things, that the whole culture of this agency evolved, and everyone said, well, what a cool place to be. So many nice people.
Yeah.
And whenever people ask me, well, I'm not too good, I have no ideas, I have nothing, then I show them there's one TED, I think it was a TEDx talk, where a little boy was talking about a bench. And this bench is somehow a friendship bench, because he was alone at his school, nobody was talking to him, and then he and his father had the idea to spend this bench, and on this bench was something said, well, I'm alone, if someone needs to likes to talk to me, I'm happy to. And then people came, and then whenever someone was alone, it was a 5-minute talk. This little 11-year-old boy was standing on the stage of TEDx and said, well, if an 11-year-old boy can tell his story about how he managed to be not alone anymore,
right?
It is so nice. It's an idea worth spreading.
It is. That's exactly
and,
right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And how, I mean, there just aren't that many opportunities. Like, everyone keeps asking me, like, who are your competitors?
Yeah.
And it's
not about the competition.
It's not about competition, but it's also not trying to have hubris about where we are. But I have a hard time trying to find someone that's the exact equivalent of this. It's so broad yet so distinct. I don't know who competes with us in this space. And we certainly would be happy to have more. I mean, the truth of the matter is, because the mission is not to be number one at ideas, it's to spread ideas. So if other people find another model or can build on this, we'd be thrilled by that.
Did you ever thought about developing out of TED a TED school or a TED university? Because what you are doing is you managed to find a way to make ideas understandable, attractive, and easy to follow.
Yes.
And this is something which our school system, I believe, is missing.
Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about it, and we have a program called TED Ed. And I think we like living in the space that where we kind of complement your standard educational experience. For instance, TED Ed, which is one of the initiatives that just kind of started about 10 years ago, just out of just sheer will and interest, is not about certification or levels of advancement, but has more to do with intellectual curiosity. So having a space that's not so curriculum defined, I think, is where we do best. Mm-hmm. And the way that we do that now is actually, particularly with companies and with organizations, nonprofits, foundations, and for-profits, is we have a series of things that we bring in. So not only do we have access to the conferences, which is simply just access to knowledge, but we also craft programs of talks specifically designed for the need or the problem that a company is trying to solve for. I need more innovation. I need to manage through disruption. I need to, change our culture, et cetera, et cetera. We can come in and kind of teach you in our way, which is by bringing different speakers and talks and curating them together, or the Institute again, which can be thematically based, where we're bringing the discipline of how to find an idea and how to develop an idea. So that's been kind of the closest corollary from an educational perspective. We also have something called Storytelling Masterclass, and this is actually speaker training. But the reason that I need to find a better phrase for it is because, to me, the performative part, the end, where you're actually learning how to speak in public, is 10% of it. Mm-hmm. The very beginning is the stuff that I mentioned at the start. What is the idea? Is it one idea? How do you make it personal? What's the story arc? Where's the solution? Where's the conflict? You know what I mean? Like, the ability for people to create that. If you don't get the content right, it doesn't matter how perfectly, poised you are on a stage, it's not going to land. So we kind of do the whole gamut versus standard media training, which just says, don't say and you blink too much, or you know what I mean? Like, those kinds of things. So those are the ways in which we do it. You can imagine there'd be a world where, we would more actively engage in something like that. At the moment, no, but everything's possible at TED.
Wow. At the end of our podcast talks, we always ask the question, what inspires you personally? And we very often ask for books you've read in your history. But I would love to ask you, what are your five most inspiring TED Talks for your life so far?
Or goodness. It
does not have to be but five you're right now, I ask you.
Yeah.
I will promise they will get some more clicks.
That's okay. It's better than asking me for my favorite, because there's no such thing. No. So there are quite a few.
I will answer it as well.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So Bryan Stevenson talks about justice. It's one of the most perfectly formed talks, but it's also massively inspiring. Mm-hmm. Robin Steinberg, who's an audacious winner. It's a huge program where we get funding for these really big audacious problems that they're trying to solve for. Hers has to do with the Bail Project and mass incarceration. It's a brilliant talk and a clever, clever, clever solution of basically reusing funds to bail people out before they're convicted, which then gets returned back into the system that keeps helping people who are, picked up on the street, not proven guilty, but then gets stuck with a cash bail. It's such a beautiful talk. There was a talk by Sam Harris a couple of years ago. There was a trifecta of talks that actually turned me off to social media. And they were all in sequence, 6 months apart. Mm-hmm. But it somehow had an impact on me. It was basically like, AI, like, have we lost control? Mm-hmm. And it was the notion that, and I know that there are a lot of talks right now about AI for good, but there is this idea that we're starting to kind of work ourselves out of a solution. Like there's almost no capacity to fully understand and control artificial intelligence as it moves forward, which was kind of a frightening concept to me. Mm-hmm. Then there was another talk by Zeynep Tufekci where she talked about the inherent bias that comes through AI, because there's something weird about tech. You think it's neutral, but it's in fact human beings that are coding it. And then Tristan Harris came out and spoke about these different social platforms and how essentially manipulated we are. And those three talks, I think, kind of changed my own personal life in terms of kind of getting off social media, saving more time to do things like listen to TED Talks and meditate and spend time with my kids.
Oh, cool. How old are they? Your kids?
They're 12 and almost 14.
Perfect.
Yes, yes. And they listen to just TED Talks endlessly. There are great leadership talks. There's an incredible one by Margaret Heffernan where she talks about super chickens and team dynamics. There are just so many. I have a list so long that when people ask me to send it to them, I feel badly because I'm drowning them with too many ideas.
If you could send them to us, it would be very nice. We would put the list into our readers list we have, or maybe we start a new list, which is the TED Talk list.
Yeah, of course.
I just will name two TED Talks which really influenced me. The first was Simon Sinek.
Of course.
Which is a bad quality of production because it's a very old TEDx talk,
right.
But it's amazing. I think he's among the top five viewers, 40 million. His model really influenced my work deeply. But the most influencing guy on TED, I have to say, I saw the TED talk while reading the book, so the book is even more influencing, is Matthew Walker, who is a Berkeley professor who wrote a book, and he's talking in a TED talk about it, Why We Sleep.
And of course.
This really is, for me, the most shocking and positive aspect.
Was it the one that we just had in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Talk. Yeah. I made my entire family watch it, including my children.
Yeah. It's so everything. I was proud member of the 5 a.m. club. I do meditation and then I do some stretching and then I do deep work and then I bring tea to my wife. And she said, Michael, fuck you. You have to sleep. And if you don't sleep until 7, go into your other bedroom because everyone needs sleep. My wife is very wise. And he says there is no such thing that people just need 6 hours sleep. It's wrong.
It's a farce. And you can't catch up on it.
No, you can't catch up on it.
I didn't get it this week, so I'm going to go on the weekend and catch up.
And many people who did this for their whole life, like Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, get Alzheimer's. So there is a correlation.
Oh, 100%.
And so on. So,
That was a brilliant talk because it was also grounded in so many statistics that were astonishing, but it was relatable to the entire world.
And it was fun as well.
And the
good thing is, just start it tomorrow and it's getting better.
That is true. That had a huge impact on that conference. I remember it. I ran home and I made my parents and husband and kids watch it. Cool. Particularly my kids.
Thank you so much for spending the time with me. And I do hope that we will see us again.
Yes, I would love that. Thank you so much.